Hi, I'm Jason Nichols, and I'm on the left.
And I'm Vince Colonnaise, and I'm on the right.
And if we can't find common ground in this world today, then we're all just travelers.
Passing each other in an international airport.
In this great American experiment,
we'll be relegated to the trash bin of history.
So let's come together
to debate without yelling, and let's save this nation.
Coming up, a Republican congresswoman from Colorado joins us on Vince and Jason Save the Nation. Vince and Jason Save the Nation is brought to you by Goldco.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Vince and Jason Save the Nation. I'm Dr. Jason Nichols. That is my good friend, Vince Colonnaise. And we have a special guest today with us. Vince, let us know who we have.
This is Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert from Colorado, who joins us today. Congresswoman, so great to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Vince. Thanks, Jason, for having me. This should be fun and exciting. I'm looking forward to our chat today.
Yeah, we are too, for sure. Let me jump right into your basic assessment of how things are going for the country right now. You saw former President Barack Obama show up at the White House yesterday. I think anyone who is kind of like just politically attuned understands that that's a big deal for the Biden White House. They want to bring in Obama in a midterm election year. He's much more popular, clearly. Than Joe Biden is. But to me, that seems like...
I thought Biden was the most popular president ever elected. 81 million votes, right?
Sure. But when I look at that, what I'm seeing is they need kind of window dressing over a bunch of other issues that are festering in the country that need to be addressed. How do you rank the priorities in terms of what we need to address in our country?
First and foremost, I would rank our border as the top priority. We have a complete invasion taking place at our southern border with 2.5 million illegal aliens coming into our country. And that's just who we know about. That does not include hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of what Border Patrol agents call gotaways, people who were not apprehended whatsoever. And those are probably the most dangerous of the people that are coming across, because those would be the criminal aliens who do not want to turn themselves over to the Border Patrol. But certainly we need to get our inflation under control. And that starts in Washington, D.C. I voted against trillions and trillions of dollars in spending, where the federal government is just printing money. And it is absolutely devastating our economy. And this is why we're seeing inflation the way we are. And then, of course, coinciding with that, we have to get America energy independent. We are currently funding the Kremlin and really both sides of Putin's war right now. If Congress wants to pat themselves on the back and say, don't worry, we sent aid to Ukraine, so we did something really good and we all wore blue and yellow, so look at how great we're doing here in Congress. But really, we are importing 100,000 barrels of oil from Putin every day and sending him a $10 million check each day. This has to stop. Under President Trump, America was energy independent for the first time in 72 years. And we should still be energy independent, not dipping into our strategic oil reserves, right. But we should be pursuing energy dominance and literally exporting freedom throughout the world.
So we've got a limited amount of time. I want to ask you, what exactly does energy independence mean to you? Because I think people have different definitions. And by one definition, we are still energy independent, meaning that we are a net exporter of energy, which would include natural gas, coal, and petrol. I think what a lot of people are saying is that we're talking about petrol. And then with regard to that, in 2020, we were energy independent because we were locked down and no one was driving and no one was using oil. So of course we were exporting more than we were actually needing to use.
We were energy independent before the lockdowns. We were energy independent, and this was something that we were touting under President Trump's administration. But energy independent means we don't beg OPEC for more oil. We rely
on oil independence. That's what you're referring to.
All of it. Not energy. No. All of the above. And especially if you're-
So we're still energy independent. Correct.
If you're going to... No, we are not. We are currently dependent on what Putin is doing. And that's why you are paying more at the gas pump right now. That is why moms and dads are having a hard time driving to work.
But isn't it true that we've ended our relationship with Russian oil and the fact that
No, it is not true.
We only had about 8% I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have a very short amount of time. If we had an hour, one of the things Vince and I, we never cut people off.
It is not true that we ended that with Russia. In fact, Nancy Pelosi played a fun little con game where she had a suspending energy imports bill from Russia that the House voted on and Biden signed after the Senate passed it as well. This, first of all, had 45 days to be enacted. I think we're 29 days into that now. So everything is still flowing for 45 days, but there are waivers all throughout that bill excluding Russian oil and gas from this. So the Russian oil and gas still keep flowing even after the 45 days. It was a fake Russian oil ban.
Hmm. Well, I think there is some broad agreement. I think all of a sudden there's this realization, including, you know, some of the institutions that fund the American left that, we do need to open up the spigots a bit on oil. I mean, I did see this report from the Wall Street Journal yesterday that the Biden administration, although they're not thinking about increasing American energy production, they are thinking about importing Canadian oil all of a sudden, at least in the short term, to help bring down some of these gas prices. But they're not greenlighting the Keystone XL pipeline. I just can't understand that, because you have a situation where if you care about the environment, I mean, the cleanest way to actually get that oil from Canada to the United States would be that pipeline, Congresswoman.
Correct. And that was canceled on day one. But the Nord Stream 2 pipeline for Putin was greenlighted. That was approved by Joe Biden. And, you know, I am for an all of the above energy approach, but I don't want to sacrifice American energy independence at the altar of climate change. We can have these green energy policies, these unreliables like wind and solar, but we need to be able to mine for those products in America, not rely on our adversaries and outsource that to our adversaries. China owns mines, the cobalt mines in the Congo, where there are currently 40,000 children mining for that cobalt with their bare hands. And then that cobalt is shipped to China. They make solar panels, and then we buy solar panels for them. And once again, feel really good about ourselves. But it's really just this not my backyard extremist mentality that says you go ahead and mine it over there, tear up your land, use child and slave labor in your country, and then we'll buy the products and feel really good about ourselves like we did something important.
Right.
So since we have a limited amount of time, there's so much that we would like to talk to you about. So we'd love to have you back if you can make the time for us. We usually do about an hour or 45 minutes. We did that with Ted Cruz, Jim Jordan, Ro Khanna, lots of your colleagues. I wanted to ask, about some of your most recent public statements. You said that people should be 21 before they make life-altering decisions regarding their sexuality and sex life.
That we should be chemically castrating our children or physically castrating our children. That needs to be the choice of an adult. If an adult wants to change parts of their body, that's fine. This should not be happening in children. And we certainly shouldn't be pushing this grooming agenda in our schools. Children should not be talking about sex.
So you think people are being groomed to be transgender? Was that your school experience?
I think they're being sexualized. They're being taught about sex and being awakened to that much.
So you're against sex education? Is that what you're saying?
In elementary school, in middle school, yes, I am.
Middle school? You're against it when kids start going through puberty?
It absolutely starts sexualizing our children.
I just want to be clear. No sex education in middle school. So seventh, eighth graders should not get sex education.
They shouldn't have comprehensive sex ed like we have in Colorado. This is something that.
What is comprehensive sex ed? I'm not familiar. I'm not from Colorado.
Comprehensive sex ed isn't just saying I'm a boy, you're a girl. These are my parts. These are your parts. This isn't what comprehensive sex ed is. It actually goes much deeper into that, and that's where you do get this LGBTQ. Mentality that comes in and teaches kids how to have and enjoy same-sex sex. And of course, sex with the opposite gender, which there are only two. This is what's happening in comprehensive sex ed. I don't think that seventh graders and eighth graders need to be taught how to enjoy sex, how to pleasure themselves. This is not for teachers to be teaching our children. These are this is a conversation that needs to be had in the home at an appropriate time. But this is not something that should be taught in public schools, especially in elementary school where it is taking place.
Congresswoman, on this issue, are you encouraged by the rise in some Republicans? And I think that includes you, who are willing to take on these corporations who support that agenda. You saw Disney has come out. They're against that bill, that legislation in Florida that would prevent, sexual identity conversations, for 8-year-olds. Are you supportive of the effort to push back against these corporations, including if it means the loss of those jobs in states like Florida?
Look, you go woke, you go broke. So I don't have too much more to say about that. But, this bill that is so wrongly named by folks that are woke, this don't say gay bill, it could also be called the don't say straight bill. This is not sexualizing our children. This is not introducing kindergartners, first graders, second graders into this sexual life. So I'm absolutely for the legislation. I think Governor Ron DeSantis has done a fantastic job. And if Disney has a problem with that, then, they're going to have backlash from parents who have a problem with them supporting that. Disney, this is a corporation that has filmed movies where Uyghurs are in encampments, in encampments being enslaved. And they're completely fine with that. But they're saying, we don't want to do business in Florida because of this bill that is set forth to protect our children. I don't think so. I'm not buying any of that.
So again, going back kind of on this issue of Disney, and you tweeted out about Mickey Mouse, MickeyMouse, just want to say that. The trademark, and again, in terms of the spelling, who cares? That's not that important. I'm just saying because I was a kid and I watched the show. You said that Congress,
it's my official account.
You were going to take away.
I have staff that type those up. I say it, they type it, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I guess they were too young for
maybe
Mickey Mouse Club. At any rate, so your staff said that Congress, should take away Mickey Mouse's trademark. Now, we know that is not the role of Congress, and Mickey Mouse's trademark won't expire.
I think Obama had a different point of view whenever he was in office. Maybe you should
research not really
a
my question.
More,
my question is, isn't that kind of an example of cancel culture? Isn't that like going after corporations just the way the left did with Hobby Lobby?
I will go after anyone who tries to protect the grooming and the sexualization of our children. Jason, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Vince, it's been a pleasure. And
thanks.
I would love to come back and spend some more time with you guys.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you, Congresswoman.
Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, due to our abbreviated time today, unexpected, to be honest with you, with Congressman Lauren Boebert, we do hope we have her back. But Jason and I wanted to have kind of an extended conversation. So this is for you, the audience. And I think there's a lot going on, Jason. And
absolutely.
I want to dwell on this Disney fight in Florida. And you don't have to like the specifics of the bill, or we don't have to get into the back and forth on the legislation. But I think just the broader cultural topic about sexual conversations and when it's okay as a culture to begin those with children, and whether it's okay to prevent them. I feel like there's really, as much as like the media frames this as a partisan debate, there's a lot of bipartisan consensus on this. I mean, looking in Florida in particular, the bill that DeSantis just signed into law, it had the support of the majority of Florida Democrat primary voters. Now that's interesting. And that's like, I think it's a sign that parents are protective of their kids and they want to have a lot of these important conversations themselves rather than shopping them out to strangers.
Yeah, it's interesting with this bill because, everything that I've read from it, I haven't read the direct piece of legislation. So I have to admit that. But everything, all the quotes that I've read from the bill, it's really vague and up to interpretation. So I can't really say, a whole lot about you know, because some people are promoting it as don't say gay. Some people are saying, hey, let's leave sexuality out of the conversation until kids are actually facing that. I think many of us know, you know, we have an instinct about our sexuality really early on, you know, but you don't really start having that conversation. And this was part of the interview with the congresswoman, because I, you know, obviously, I think, you know, middle school kids, you know, you can start having those conversations. And we one of the things that we've seen is that a lot of kids on the LGBT spectrum, LGBTQ, there are things like depression, bullying, and suicide attempts.
Yes.
And so having that conversation in a space where they're with their peers so that they don't feel so isolated. And everyone, yeah. I understand the argument about these are the conversations that should be happening in the home, but a lot of kids' homes aren't welcoming to those conversations.
But see,
it's probably safer with their peers and with, you know, within, yeah. you know, moderated by an adult.
Well, I don't know. I mean, see, That's where I hesitate. You're right. There are households where you don't have enough love and health and encouragement. There's definitely that. But I think it's dangerous to then entrust these types of important conversations to strangers, and especially to peer groups, children, and the conversations that they have and the paths that they go down can be very dangerous. In fact, I think one of the great problems we have as a society right now is that far too many children are being raised by strangers on the internet, that they're getting more of their right. moral guidance from TikTok than they are from their parents. Now, that's dangerous. It's very dangerous because those strangers don't have the interests of that child at heart at all. I'm not saying they're trying to exploit them, but I do feel that, although there are people out there like that, clearly, I do think that like they're deriving lessons about life from people who don't care at all about their lives. And so on the yeah. issue of transgender conversations in particular for young children, one, I think it's a big mistake to suggest to a child who's deeply impressionable. This is like, you know, anybody who deals with Christmas and Santa Claus understands this. You have kids who are getting the suggestion that their bodies might be a mistake at a very young age. That is not the kind of conversation that you should be putting in front of a 6, 7, or 8-year-old at all. And I think you're robbing them of their innocence. You're creating confusion for them. And I'll go a step further here on this issue of transgenderism. I think as an adult, the more you become familiar with the world, the more you engage with ideas, the more, and obviously as an adult, you really have sovereignty over your own body. You're entitled to make decisions about what you want to do with it and how you want to alter it. But as a child, I think that, you know, what you're enabling is dissent. Like if a kid comes to you and said, like, if you discover that your child is on drugs, for instance, you're not going to abet it. That's what we call enabling, right? That's like, mm-hmm. that's like you're allowing their dissent to continue unencumbered. In fact, you're accelerating it. And I worry that with transgender concepts, you know, where somebody says, I think I'm actually a completely different gender than the one I actually am, than my biological sex, then there's this cultural pressure right now to, quote, affirm it, that you have to affirm that. And that's the healthy thing to do. And I submit it is the unhealthy thing to do, because what you're doing is you're not assessing fully all of the multivariate reasons that child might be reaching that conclusion. And you're instead enabling their descent into a destructive lifestyle that's not going to be good for them. There's nothing empathetic about it. It's abandonment. And so I would say we should, like, with all of that, like, if you want to be empathetic, you want to help kids out, you know, don't lead them down the road to destruction and tend to their actual needs and, like, care for them.
So I first of all, let me be clear that I hear what you're saying. I definitely don't think that, and the congresswoman had said some things about sexualizing young children. I think it's a little different when you start saying, you know, 21. I think that's, we allow people to go to war at 18.
Yeah.
You know, we allow people to make really serious life and death decisions. You know, you can buy a gun at 16 in some states. So like, there are a lot of situations where we entrust, we you know, with all of the deaths that we get from automobiles, we let young people drive. Right. I think you can make certain decisions, you know, when you're younger than 21. I'm not going to sit here and pick a time or, you know, whatever. But certainly younger than 21. So I can, you know, I'm not sure that we see eye to eye on that, but I definitely understand about, you know, the impulse to say, hey, let's not talk about sexual anything in first, second, and third grade. Let's let kids explore what it is and come to their own conclusions about sexuality and gender identity and all of that.
Look, my kid's 7 years old right now. She's in second grade. I was just going over her homework with her. She was doing social studies homework. She's learning the continents and the oceans right now.
Right.
That's where she is. And she's in second grade. Yeah. She's a smart kid. Sure. And what she's smarter than I am, because I didn't realize that there were five oceans.
I don't doubt
that. Did you know there were five oceans?
I did.
When did that happen? Because when we were growing up, it was four.
So Atlantic, Pacific.
Yeah.
Indian Ocean. Arctic, right?
You got it. That's the four. I will not blame you if you do not get this.
Oh, man. I thought there were five. What is the fifth one?
The Southern Ocean.
Okay, I did not know that.
The Southern Ocean is the ocean that bands around Antarctica. So I'm like, she's going down. And she's like, she's got the five oceans. And I was like, what? Where did five oceans come? We lost Pluto and we got an ocean. Do you understand what has changed?
So is that based on like the currents or like, how does that work?
It's some bored scientist with way too much influence was like, you know what we're going to do? The Anthony Fauci of naming oceans was like, you know what? We're strapping on another ocean. Anyway, the point is, this is where they are. This is where at second grade, this is like right in the wheelhouse of where this debate is happening. You're seeing, it's like, no, look, they've got so many basics to learn about the world. And additionally, again, I think it's very dangerous to teach children that their body's a mistake. I really do. I think that's the kind of thing that can wreck a kid.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's not my understanding of trans identity. I don't think it's saying that your body is a mistake. But you know, and again, I don't pretend to be an expert on this issue. I do have some trans friends, and they inform me, and there are a few things I disagree with. Like, you know,
and by the way, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, you know, I have some trans friends and allies of trans people. I like to think that I'm an ally, but you know, I let other people decide that. But you know, there are some things I disagree with. I disagree with the idea that, you know, for example, that Caitlyn Jenner was always Caitlyn Jenner and there was never Bruce. And I'm like, no, Bruce existed. Like, mm-hmm. Bruce was a person.
But that's, you know, called, and that's called dead naming, though. You know, that's like, people are like it's like a sin to invoke the existence of Bruce Jenner.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Caitlyn doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that Bruce also existed. And for people who want to talk about, like, you know, their kind of intersectional analysis, I'm like, yeah, well, you're negating all of the advantages that Bruce gained before he became Caitlyn from being a straight, you know, athletic, talented white man. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, you're all, so I think that this idea that he was always Caitlyn is not only materially incorrect, but I think it's also just not right. I think that Bruce existed. Maybe he felt, you know, Caitlyn brewing inside. And then when he transitioned, he brought Caitlyn out. And that's okay. I mean, I think there was a Cassius Clay and then there was a Muhammad Ali.
But like, see, here's something there, like Bruce Jenner, now known as Caitlyn Jenner, is out there saying that...
Who works for Fox News, by the way.
Yeah, who just got hired by Fox to be a contributor. So is out there now saying that he would never compete. Like, the idea is that not that he would never compete as a woman. He thinks that that's completely wrong. It should be, as I understand it, just based on what your sex is. Like, whatever your sex is, that's the athletic competition you should be in. Do you agree with that?
Well, the funny thing about that is he still took Woman of the Year in
ESPN,
Vogue or Cosmo.
Wasn't it like, didn't ESPN do that? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was, maybe Vogue or I'll look it up.
I mean, I think he got a couple of those, So it's really ironic that he's going to be like, no, you can't compete. There were other women out there saving people's lives and doing all kinds of crazy
stuff. Glamour magazine named Caitlyn Jenner the 2015 Woman of the Year.
Yeah. So she, she didn't give that back, or take that title and say, no, I'm not Woman of the Year. I'm Trans Person of the Year. She didn't do that. She accepted, I'm Woman of the Year. So I think it's, and there were other women that, who were cisgender, who did incredible things in 2015, but didn't get that recognition because Caitlyn took it. So until she goes and says, hey, I'm going to give that back. I'm not Woman of the Year. I don't know. But I'll say this, in terms of the competition, I see both points, and I was reading this article actually that made a really interesting point, and it was, why can't co-ed sports be a thing? Like, why can't we have co-ed sports, co-ed relays in swimming, all of these kinds of co-ed competitions, and trans people could compete with, say you have a two-person relay, or like mixed doubles, they can compete with either, it can be a trans woman who competes with a cisgender man, or a trans woman who competes with a cisgender woman, or a trans person who competes with a trans person. Trans people are kind of like the Joker's wild. They can compete with whomever, and then we can, they can actually still compete and win medals and win awards and all those kinds of things. And I thought that was actually an interesting proposal.
But how would you categorize a trans person for addition to that sport? So, let me give you an example of where this already occurs, co-ed sports. Office softball leagues.
Right.
Office softball leagues, you usually have to have one or two women on the team. And, as a requirement. So, sure. If you're including a transgender person, how do you make the decision about which category they fit into for the office softball team?
I think you don't make that decision. I think you let the trans person decide. Like, the office softball team, first of all, if you're taking office softball that seriously, that you're like, that team has an advantage, they got a trans person. Like,
some offices
tripping.
Do.
Something's
wrong. It's a big deal. If you can make, if all of a sudden you went from your shortstop being a girl to a guy, it does actually change the likelihood that you will win that game.
I mean, if they're taking, again, your average trans woman is not Leah Thomas. That's what people are kind of missing out on, is this idea that your average trans person is going to be 6'5 with a 7-foot wingspan. And by the way, Leah Thomas did place 8th and 5th in some other races.
Meaning,
she was not as dominant as people made it seem. But either way, your average trans person who's going to be on the office softball team is going to be, and they're taking hormones to take away their muscle mass, and they want to look good in a dress. They're going to be not a whole lot better than a lot of cisgender women,
But come on, the whole reason if you're short on women and you show up and you've got all men and you're like, hey, sorry, we brought all men. No, that's not the rule. You have to have women. There's a performance difference between men and women. This is why we have separate athletic competitions at all.
Yeah. So, it also depends on the sport. So I'll just put that out there, because, for example, in gymnastics, women, cisgender women, have an advantage over cisgender men. You know what I mean? They're short, stocky. There's just an advantage that goes into a lot of gymnastics for women. And there are some sports that I'm not sure that there's a male advantage. I think it's kind of even. You were saying something about this, but at least when I think of it, like diving, you know, when I watch diving, it seems to me that the women are better than the men, or at least as good, you know. Now we're talking about things that involve like strength and power.
Well, the way they measure like diving is, you know, who makes a small splash on entry, like the grace and all of that. So you're right. There's this natural inclination just in terms of like the beauty of the actual sport to be like, well, women seem to have some sort of advantage. But what I was mentioning before is that high diving in particular, I didn't realize this until recently, at the top levels, women can't jump from as high of a height as men can, given the stresses on the body when they hit the water. I didn't know that. I was like, wow, what? I thought falling from height, I didn't think there would be any meaningful distinction, but there you go. You've got this distinction between men and women.
Yeah, but again, how much of that will change when you've changed your hormone levels? You know, you raise your estrogen levels and you lower your testosterone. That's a question that I think a lot of scientists, because, you know, so I was on social media a little while ago and, you know, I got some pushback from some of my friends who consider themselves to be trans allies, because I was like, look, I don't have an answer for the Leah Thomas thing. I don't know where I fall on that. And my main answer is, you know, just some statistics that I'm pulling up right here is LGBT youth are 4 times as likely to attempt suicide. Trans youth are twice as likely to drop out of high school. They're twice as likely to abuse alcohol. Trans homelessness for adults rose 57% between 2017 and 2019.
Yes.
38% of Black trans women are in poverty. 40% have experienced homelessness. But rather than discuss that kind of stuff, we're sitting here talking about Leah Thomas.
No,
these are first
the
world problems. Like, so this is not my number one concern for trans people.
But there are women.
I'm not concerned with this.
It is displacing. It is. I would say one, it's displacing women. You know, the idea that men would be considered the women of the year and would win athletic competitions in what's supposed to be a woman's sport, it's an offense to women. I mean, that's just true. Let me give you a way to think about this that I think is worthwhile. I just want to give you kind of a spot check on the way that this conversation has gone through the years. For a long time now, for those people who've been advocating for transgenderism broadly, they've been using this rhetorical distinction between sex and gender, right? They say sex is different than gender. Sex is what you're born with. It's your biological sex, but your gender, it's on a spectrum, right? So your gender is how you feel and how you identify, and it could be anywhere. It could be, you know, I can't name them all, but I know that there's like a huge range of what is considered a gender. People want to use different pronouns from the conventional he and she, and on and on and on. But that's distinct. That's a completely distinct category from sex. Okay. But now all of a sudden, the same group of people is eliding those differences. It's pretending like that actually you can change your sex. Because if this was principally like in sport and athletic competition, if we continue to go by what was argued 10 years ago that sex was different than gender, this is a very simple thing. Leah Thomas can't compete with women because sexually he is a male. So therefore he should just race against men. And so as just a sex matter, we have a distinction. And
so
yet what's occurred right now is that distinction has disappeared. It has outlived its usefulness. And now we're being told that you can be a completely different sex, and that that difference that once existed between sex and gender, well, that's gone.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things there. I think, and this is the interesting thing about calling people transgender, because they're not necessarily just changing their gender. Now we're saying they're changing their sex. So to me, the term transsexual would make more sense in some respects, particularly when you're taking hormone treatments and when you've literally had surgery to change your your genitalia,
mm-hmm.
To me, you are becoming a woman. And so we're saying that that is not, it is a biological construct, but that it can be altered. You know, because, and the funny thing is people don't realize in some cases, biological constructs are easier to alter than social ones. Social ones are really hard because you need broad agreement from society that we are going to change this social construct. So for example, the idea, you know, that I can be white one day, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We would need broad agreement from society. And there's a move, there's a show called Atlanta that's really hilarious. And they did this whole skit about a guy who was transracial. And like, uh-huh. It was a black guy who was like, no, I'm white. Like,
uh-huh. Rachel Dahl is all in reverse.
Yeah. So he like tried to be white. like he was calling the police on black people. Like it was hilarious. But the whole point is that what made it funny is that society would not be in broad agreement that he could become a white man. You know what I mean? Like now society has made the decision over time in some situations to have broad agreement that somebody is, you know, another race. So for example, like I've used this example a million times, society decided somewhere in the 1940s or something that the Colonnases were white. Prior to that, the Colonnases, as Italians, you know, were an olive-skinned, Romance language-speaking group of people, and they were not considered white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were considered something else. They weren't considered black, but they, you know, but they were some construct outside of whiteness. And then we had broad agreement as a society, they're going to be included in whiteness. It's harder to change those kinds of constructs than it is to biologically alter an individual. But I think a lot of us, including in the academic community, we have it in reverse. You know, we have this kind of mixed up idea that you can't, that these biological constructs are static. So that's why we will use the term transgender rather than transsexual.
Right. And because fundamentally, on a biological level, you can't change your sex. And what you can do is you can modify your appearance. You can make cosmetic changes. You can modify your chemistry. You can definitely inject hormones and things. But at the biological level, that's immutable. Your sex is immutable. It's not changing.
See, I disagree with that because, again, and this goes back to the complication with Caster
Semenya,
or I'm not sure mm-hmm. how to pronounce her name.
I think it's Caster Semenya.
Yeah. So with her, like the old school way of telling sex was the equipment you have in your, you know, with regard to your genitalia.
Right.
All this idea about chromosomes, that nobody checked your chromosome.
No, it pops up in an ultrasound. You look at, that's how you find out in an ultrasound whether you're having a boy or a girl.
Look right there.
There it is move, by the way. Did that happen with your kids? Did the tech say, there it is, or you see that or something like that and not give you a clear answer right away?
No. It's funny with my son. So I had a daughter first, and then my son, I went to the ultrasound, and I knew it was going to be a girl. I was like, it's going to be a girl. And I was kind of down about it because I wanted a son. You know what I mean? I am the last person in my family. All my uncles have girls. My dad has two brothers, and they both have two girls.
I love how honest you're being about this.
Yeah, no, I was like, with the third, I didn't care. I was like, give me whatever. I'm cool. But, you know, my son, I got to admit, it was a little bit of disappointment because I was like, it's going to be a girl. I know it's going to be a girl.
So you just had this sense. You're going in, you're like, it's going to be a girl, and you're already disappointed.
And the funny thing about it was when we looked at the ultrasound, the nurse said, and this is a quote, and I'm not giving him, any kind of props. Maybe he'll see this in 20 years and be like,
is so good.
The nurse was like, oh, that's a boy. And then I was like, I can't believe it. I don't believe it. Maybe that's a finger sticking up or something. And then the doctor came in and we were like, yeah, we just want to be sure. You know, the nurse said it was a boy. And then he looked at it and he's like, oh yeah. Yeah, that's a boy.
Oh, that's hilarious.
You know, so I was like, you know, I guess, so, it's, you know, maybe it skips a generation. No, I'm kidding. it was a funny thing. And then when the third one came, I was like,
just give me whatever.
You know,
yeah.
Give me a healthy, you know, even a non-healthy baby. Just give me a baby.
Yeah, that's right. When we went in and they did the ultrasound for the day that we would assess the gender, the nurse said, oh, there it is. And that's all she said at first.
Oh, I'm sure, like, you were like, boy.
I'm like, well, when you say there it is.
Right. Like, that, like you're looking
you're
for
sitting
something.
There going, I'm having a boy. We're having a boy. That's incredible. And then she was like, and I'm like, so what does that mean? And she's like, it's a girl, she says. I was like, why did you do that? Yeah, first of all, I'm sitting there like going through a roller coaster.
What is the with the girl? Yes. Like,
what do you mean there it is? What are you talking about? Anyway, right. So I'll admit, I'm just like you. My instinct was I wanted a boy. But I'll tell you what, I have so much regret for that position now in retrospect, because she has so brought me so much incredible joy that I'm like, oh my gosh, I couldn't even imagine a world without her. So,
absolutely.
That's like, but it is funny. That is the instinct. I don't know. Does every father feel that way? Is it even culturally, is it culturally acceptable to feel that way? To be like, boy, 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 boy. And, but you know, again, it's just, like, I'm so glad. I think I'm firmly of the opinion that, God gives daughters to men who deserve them. You know, it's like I need her in my life to help craft the way that I actually live my life. To like have some influence on the way I think about the world.
Amen to that. Amen. Mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, with daughters, you know, and I know people get upset. I know a lot of feminists get upset when you say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because this is Vincent Jason Save the Nation.
Say it, baby.
I say what I care. What I think. You know, I've always tried to be thought of myself as an advocate for women, even though, again, you know, I'm not perfect. My personal life, probably done some womanizing. Look, I'm going to put it out there. I'm not perfect in that regard. But one of the things that I've always thought, you know, was, you know, I advocate for women's rights and feminism, you know, the broad tenets of feminism and womanism. But it was interesting, when I had a daughter, sexism became real for me. Like, you know, like the things that women discuss, I thought of them on an academic level.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to really see, like, I don't know, it really hit me, like, wow, why do I want a boy? Is it because I deep down in my mind, I think there are certain things that are going to be easier for him because he's a boy, you know? I think there is some of that. I mean, most of it, I think, is...
Was your son your first child?
No, he was the second.
Oh, okay.
You know, so my daughter, and maybe if I have another child, it'll be a boy, because we went girl, boy, girl.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also realized the pressures on men, you know, and the pressures on Black men. And, you know, those are things that I have to think about as well.
Mm.
It's funny. As you were mentioning the thing about Leah Thomas, I wanted to ask you what you thought about, like, in terms of prison confinement.
Yeah.
Where should, you know, trans women, because all of this is about is trans women. We're not talking about trans men, because trans men, generally, and again, you know, where I think with the prison confinement discussion, we need to discuss, like, where do you confine a trans man? But I'll just say real quick, you know, the when they're playing, you know, I interviewed this trans man who played semi-pro football.
Yeah.
And obviously had no physical advantage, you know what I mean? But he played.
What position?
He played safety. safety and corner.
That's not a small deal.
Yeah, no, it was a big deal. I mean, and it was semi-pro. It's not like he, you know, blue chipper we're talking here. But, and I asked him if his teammates knew that, he was born female. And he said no. You know, he said he thinks some of them might have an inkling, but he was like, no. But he goes out there, he plays, he hits, you know, people.
Yeah.
And he doesn't complain. And no one seems to complain about, you know, him playing.
Right.
They don't know, but again, he's not a kicker.
Yeah.
He goes out and is in the trenches and plays safety.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out there. But when it comes to prison confinement, this also makes us, which I think is, to me, more important than Leah Thomas and whether she gets a freaking trophy. Like that, to me, an amateur swim meet doesn't mean anything when we got people dying, trans people dying on the street. That literally, this is not an issue, in my opinion. But I understand your point about fairness, and you know, I acknowledge that. But it's just, for me, is it an issue that I'm gonna hit the streets on? Am I gonna be like, Leah Thomas should be able to?
Like, but if it was your daughter, you may actually feel very animated about it.
About her, like in the swim meet, getting a silver medal instead of a gold or something like that.
Yeah, you'd be livid.
I don't know, man. Like, I really don't. Like, my daughter plays sports now. If there's a trans girl that plays and dominates, you know, I'm going to be honest. Like, there's a, you know, and she's 6'5", and she has a wingspan like Leah Thomas. You know, I'm going to probably be like, you know, a little asterisk. Like, all right, she beat you because, you know, she's 6'5".
It's just, look, the social pressure is really great for you to moderate your feelings about this. The social pressure is immense. It's like, don't you speak out. Don't be bigoted. But, and by the way, look at all the fathers who aren't saying anything. They're not. They're just sitting on the sidelines, shutting their mouths. And I kind of thought, like, where the hell are all these fathers? Like, how come... Like, it's left to the girls, these college age girls, to speak out, and typically anonymously, to these news outlets in order to express their frustration, because people are so scared of the social consequences of speaking out against it. And I think that's such a distortion. I think we shouldn't be.
You know, this is the thing. We should be able to dialogue. It's funny. I'm doing a presentation in about an hour and a half. I have to go to work, and I'm doing a presentation on dialectics, you know, and one of the things about dialectics, if you know anything about Marxism and dialectics, you know, it's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And I think that's what we do here is, like, you know, we each have our ideas. And one of the things that Hegel said is that we need to debate ideas with people with a different worldview than us.
Right.
We need to have that. We need to hear their side because that's how we get to truth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is for us to actually have the discussion, have the debate. And I'm willing to hear both sides. I also want to hear from the science community. I've read both, you know, I've read kind of scientists who don't really have a conclusion on whether, you know, hormone levels are the key to making athletics fair between trans women and cisgender women. And I've also heard, you know, people, you know, there's some who say, look, well, there's still bone density and blah, 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 blah. And then there's some that say, nah, the hormones make it fair. They're tall women that, you know, they're women with different levels of bone density.
But there's things. Let me address a couple of the things you brought up, because I know you had a question.
But I do want to get to the prison confinement thing, because I really think, like, trans people, both men and women, if you put them with their trans identity, with their gender identity that they've adopted, that puts them in danger. If you put a trans man in with cisgender men in prison, that puts them in extra danger for sexual assaults, for all kinds of things that could happen.
It works the other way too. And so here's my thought on this. One, on athletic competition, I have no problem with biological women playing with men by and large, because that's, I think, a choice on their part. Unless like women have some sort of sport where they are, where they're naturally advantaged, then I might have a concern. But by and large, most sports, men have the advantage just in terms of actual benchmarks, you know, times and weights and achievements. So it doesn't go both ways. This is really about men invading women's sports. On the other side, the prison question, this is a question of safety and well-being for sure. And we there's a reason we separate prison populations by sex. And so you try to keep women together, you try and keep men together and keep them separate. And, you know, already prison is perilous, you know, for men who are in prison with other men is perilous. And for women, for that matter, in prison with other women. But here's what happens. We have real world examples of men who identify as women who've been put into women's prisons and then sexually assaulted the women that they were put in prison with. That's happened plenty of times. And there's genuine anecdotes of that all over the place. And so that shouldn't happen. Like, prison populations should be based on what your sex is. So you should be put, if you're a sexual male, you should be put in prison with men. And if you're a sexual female, you should be put in prison with women.
Yeah, it's tough because if you put a trans anybody in with cisgender men, I think they're in danger. You know, if you put a trans, because they're, you know, there are some, and I've known some dudes who've gone to prison,
yeah,
and said that a lot of the trans women who go there, they end up getting either sexually assaulted, and a lot of them end up getting married on the yard for protection because they're, you know, they're terrified. They have to, you know, they latch on to one
nightmare.
Person
what
who will nightmare. Protect them.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of times all the dudes that I've known who've gone to prison, you know, everyone thinks prison rape happens all the time. And the dudes I've known who've gone to prison say it definitely happens, but it's not the way society thinks. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like every night somebody's getting, you know,
yeah.
You're getting sexually assaulted like that. You know, a lot of the prison gangs have rules against that. It's not what people think. And I also think all of the people that say rape is wrong and have all of these strong thoughts, which I hope is everybody, don't make prison rape jokes. Those jokes are not funny. You know what I mean? Like, that's like something somebody really experiences, you know what I mean? And, and think about your mom or your dad or whoever else being in those circumstances. Like, you know, they got in for bad checks or something, they go to prison. They don't deserve to get raped. That would be cruel and unusual. So don't make jokes about it.
Yeah.
But that's just, you know, me kind of getting on my soapbox. Cause I think that, you know, I think rape is
Can I just ask you a blanket question? Are you against like all offensive jokes?
No.
I mean, cause like, there's a lot of people tell jokes. They don't mean like, you know, I don't think anybody, as you pointed out, I don't think anybody's for rape. I mean, like, unless you're like an actual rapist and then, yeah. But the point is like, there's like the reason people tell jaw-droppingly offensive jokes is because it hits you somewhere in like in your mind that makes you have this reaction like, oh my God, I can't believe he just said that. Like there's all sorts of jokes that fit that category. So like once you start going down the road of making a rule, like don't tell any prison rape jokes, like, well, then all of a sudden, like every other completely offensive joke is out of bounds. And I don't know. I kind of like the world where offensive jokes are in bounds.
All right. So let me ask you this. If someone made a joke about raping your wife, would you think that was acceptable?
No, I'd be furious about that.
Right. So I'm not saying that there should be a law against, you know, telling that joke. If you want to tell a joke that is awful and offensive,
yeah,
go for it. I'm just saying, if you want to be a good person, you know, I mean, it's kind of like, and you know, with rape and sexual assault, I think about, did you ever watch the show SVU?
No, but I'm aware of it.
Okay. So Law and Order SVU, at the beginning of Law and Order SVU, for anybody who's watching, you know that they say in the criminal justice system, sex crimes are considered particularly heinous.
Right.
And to me, a sex crime is worse than a murder. I know people who've killed people and like, you know, and usually there are circumstances where I'm like, I kind of see, you know.
Well, you're right. You're right in terms of the way we think of it as a culture, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that that way of thinking of it is not the wrong way to think about it. You know, you think about Cain Velasquez and him shooting someone who molested a loved one of his. Like, I kind of have a little bit of empathy for that.
For sure.
I think
there's a reason the phrase there are worse things than death exist. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think that Cain Velasquez, don't get me wrong, for anybody who's like, oh my God, he went, like, you should go through the legal processes. That's why we have them. But you can't tell me you don't understand the impulse to want to take justice in your own hands with what I think is the most egregious, horrible, disgusting crime that you can commit, which is a sex crime. You know what I mean? There's no other way to violate somebody. You know what I mean?
Tell people the Cain Velasquez story so they understand what you're talking about.
So Cain Velasquez, if you're not a UFC fan, Cain Velasquez was the first Latino heavyweight champion in the UFC. Great fighter, had some injuries, is out of the fight game right now. Even though I've read from some people that trained with him that he could actually come back, you know, he's in a good enough shape. But allegedly, a man had sexually assaulted a family member of his. And he found that man and shot the guy, and the guy died. And now there are a couple of things here. This man was not tried or convicted. So I'm not saying that what Cain Velasquez did was right. I don't want anybody to get me wrong here, because that guy didn't get to go through a trial and get to deny what happened or anything like that, at least to my understanding.
Let me adjust your understanding.
Sure,
because here's
sure.
what I know.
Absolutely.
This is attempted murder. Was not a successful murder.
I think guy died, though. Didn't he die?
Let me read from his Wikipedia.
Okay.
I know this is crowdsourcing Wikipedia, but this is what they say. February 28th, 2022, Velasquez allegedly shot a man in Santa Clara County, California. Shot at a man, that is, and hit an unintended victim. The man who Velasquez shot at, Harry Galarte Jr., had been arrested prior to the shooting for allegedly committing child sexual abuse acts at a daycare attended by one of Velasquez's young relatives. Galarte was later released from custody on personal recognizance. An armed Velasquez allegedly chased after a vehicle that contained Galarte Jr. and his stepfather. He rammed it. He pulled out his firearm. He shot at Galarte through the window, but missed, and instead hit his stepfather and caused him non-life-threatening injuries. Okay. Velasquez was later arrested and booked into Santa Clara County Jail on an attempted first-degree murder charge. And then he was formally charged with one count of attempted first-degree murder, as well as several additional charges as well. So that's my understanding of this.
So wait, how do you get a first-degree murder charge?
Attempted first-degree.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's basically vigilante justice in the wake of a sexual assault allegation involving children.
Oh, so yeah. So this is, I'm glad you did that, Vince, because this is why you don't listen to your friends or your, so I think one of my students said, no, the guy died. So I was like, oh, the guy died. You know what I mean? Cause I remember it was attempted murder. When I first read the reports, which was right when it happened, when there were scant details. But, you know, I remember one of my students recently was like, no, the guy died. So I'm glad you cleared that up. Thank you so much, Vince.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. I was looking that up. Because I vaguely knew some of the details. And the reason I asked you to describe it is because I remember Dana White reacting to all of this. And he seemed to be like kind of understanding of Velasquez's actions.
Yeah,
but sorry that it went down, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all are. Like, and again, unfortunately, the guy who got hit wasn't the guy who was intended to get hit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, it's a 63-year-old man suffering a gunshot is, you know, that's pretty serious.
Right.
And I'm not saying that what Cain Velasquez did was right. I'm just saying we can understand it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
We can understand the impulse. And I'm not saying free Cain Velasquez because, you know, he shot a guy who didn't even do anything. But I understand. I will say this. I hope Cain Velasquez doesn't spend the rest of his life behind bars, you know, for something that I think as a society, most people can understand the impulse. So anyway, my point is, I'm not saying make a law against telling jokes of any kind.
Right.
I'm all for free speech. And that was kind of my question to Congressman Boebert. If I had gotten a chance to actually get it out, my point was, isn't that kind of canceling? Like, you know, Disney, the law, unfortunately, in my opinion, looks at corporations as individuals. Individuals are allowed to have political views. So that would include Hobby Lobby and Chick-fil-A and, mm-hmm. you know, who had their anti-LGBT kind of, you know, views and
yeah.
their religious views. It's a discussion, again, that there's so much nuance in, and this is why I'm so glad, like going back to dialectics, this is why I'm so glad to have these kind of highbrow conversations with you, Vince, mm-hmm. is because of the fact that, you know, I'm not 100%, you know, I don't have, you know, my flag in the ground that says,
yeah,
liberal. I totally only a dope. Think this
only,
and that.
Only a dope would have their mind made up on everything.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that means that, you know, you're basically there are things I will say that when the right says it, I'm more skeptical. let me look into it a little more because it may make sense to me, but there's probably something I disagree with.
I think the trick is to broaden that impulse out to everybody.
Yeah.
So it's that like, a lot of people just kind of inherit their political ideology from their friends or from their family or whoever's just the most influential in their lives. And then they rarely take an inventory of what that ideology means. They don't like open up the box, rifle around, assess it. Why do I believe this individually? It's because honestly, most people do it because it's easy. It's like, you know what? I'm going to go with this because I don't need, like, they want acceptance among their peer group, whatever it is, right? And so there's not a lot of like taking an inventory of your political views. Why do you believe this? Are there better solutions? There's not a tremendous amount of scrutiny on those points. Or maybe you have one point you care about and then you adopt the rest of the platform of the political party because you happen to agree with them. You're a single issue voter, that is. So it's totally a worthwhile exercise. Yeah. I don't know. I might... As I've gotten older, I've questioned a lot more, and that includes with both Democrats and Republicans, for sure.
Yeah, I will say this. Like, I just want to reiterate, obviously, Congresswoman Boebert and I have some serious disagreements. and maybe we disagree on this, too. But I would say spelling is not important. Spelling is just something to dunk on people on Twitter about. But
her Twitter account, for people who didn't cobble it together, had misspelled Mickey Mouse. They left out the E, I believe.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, those of us who are of that generation, you know, we know M-I-C-K-E-Y.
Yeah, they made a whole song for it.
Yeah. You know, M-I-C, see you real soon. K-E-Y. Why? Because we like you. You know what I mean? Like, that was the whole thing. But my thing is, she's a little bit younger, number one. She's younger than I am. You know, I'm of the Justin Timberlake was on Mickey Mouse Club.
Mickey Mouse Club.
And so was
Britney Spears
and Christina Aguilera, and Jessica Simpson got cut. It's actually a really interesting story how she got cut. I don't know if you've ever heard it, but like, she was like there and she was, you know, one of the finalists, and before she's about to do the final audition, which is singing, which wasn't her strongest point. You know, she was like, she had rehearsed. She felt like she had a song that suited her and she was going to be okay. And, you know, before she goes in, you know, there's a smaller little blonde girl that walks in before her. And then she hears these notes belting out of somebody in this room. And the blonde girl walks out and she had to walk in after that kid. And that was Christina Aguilera. And she's like, I had to follow up Christina Aguilera. You know what I mean? And whatever you think of Christina Aguilera, I think nothing of her one way or the other. But I can acknowledge the girl can sing. She's got some...
You know something, pipes. Honestly, whenever I hear the name Christina Aguilera, just in terms of word association, I always think of Eminem. Christina Aguilera better switch me chairs. Like,
oh, yeah, right.
So he can sit down next to Carson Daly and Fred Durst. I won't take the lyric any further. But the point is, that's Eminem. It makes me think of her.
I mean, you want to sit next to Carson Daly and Fred Durst?
You got to hear the rest of the lyric to understand why he wants to sit next
why,
to him.
Yeah. Who she gave...
Yes, that's right.
Friendship to first. I just want to say spelling on Twitter in particular. I feel like Twitter puts something in there to make you misspell things. And the other thing is, I will say this.
Okay, say
I'm not in favor of the edit button.
The old edit button debate.
Yeah, I'm against the edit button. Why? Because if you don't like what you tweet, you just delete the tweet. I don't understand Twitter culture. Like, you can't delete a tweet. Yes, you can. Why not? Like, delete the tweet. And then people being like, you can't. There's all these rules around Twitter. And, you know,
here's why everyone has a beef with the edit button. They think what's going to happen is a tweet's going to go viral and then somebody's going to pull the old switcheroo. And then change the tweet so that people retweeted something that they wouldn't have endorsed if they had known that the edit was coming. So like, it's like, that's the theory. Here's the answer to it though. Facebook's already dealt with this. They put edit history on the edits, on the post. So if it's been edited, you just click to the edit history and see what it used to be. And if you see, oh, it was a misspelling. Like, I think that's a useful half measure that makes it totally fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you should be able to, like, you know, I think it's good to have, what was it, Covfefe?
Covfefe, baby.
Yeah, like, I thought that was fine. It made for a little joke. And the thing was, when I brought up the thing with Congresswoman Boebert was, and I had tons of questions I wanted to ask her. I was not expecting a tense interview like that, to be honest. That was not my expectation. We had Jim Jordan, we've had Ted Cruz, people I disagree with, but
yeah,
they've all been friendly. But you know, that one was not what I was expecting, honestly. When we were discussing with her, and like she got really sensitive about the spelling, I was like, you know. One of the things that made Trump kind of interesting was Trump laughed and leaned into the covfefe.
Yeah, there was a whole theory. There was a whole theory among some Trump supporters that he intentionally added typos to get mileage on some of these tweets. That like, and actually, you know, it's funny. Like Lauren Boebert's tweet about Mickey Mouse probably got way more reach because of the misspelling than it would have if she had just banged it out, or her staff had just banged it out without the
misspelling. Right.
So. There is an argument to be like, just to laugh it off and to be like, yeah, whatever. That's how we spell Mickey Mouse now.
Why have your staff tweet for you? Because I don't think anybody tweets for Donald Trump. I think Trump tweets for himself.
Well, I think if I remember correctly, wasn't it Scavino would tweet for him? But Trump would dictate what he wanted tweeted, or he would write it on a piece of paper or something and hand it off. I think
the misspellings, that's actually probably a smart way to do it. I remember misspelling something. I can't remember. And, you know, of course, the right leaned in on it. You know what I mean? It's funny. You know, it's funny. I was talking to my wife last night and, you know, I was being a little complainy and bellyachy is like, you know, because I'm like, yo, I'm like, anybody who sees me and knows me is on the right and hates me. You know what I mean? It sucks being hated by everybody. You know what I mean? Like being well-known in some respects, not you know, I'm not super like famous, but people know me from Tucker's show. They know me from different things.
Yeah.
And they know me from cable news, know me from doing a bunch of Fox shows and other channels. And it's like, damn, I don't have any home games. You know what I mean? This is the closest thing to a home game I get because I'm able to expand upon what it is that I'm saying. But if you looked at the comments, everybody, you know, it's like, damn, like, I don't know anybody else who has that. Like, I'm the only person I know whose audience, you know, with the exception of Juan Williams. Juan Williams, I think everybody hates him on Twitter when I look. And Jessica Tarloff suffers.
Well, this is what happens. I mean, as a basic function of being the loyal opposition who goes into environments that aren't, you know, bubbles for your view, you'll be faced with that. And so, you know, you look at, you know, like I think of, I mean, look at like Jeff Lord. He's not on CNN anymore. When Jeffrey Lord would go on, people would just savage him for appearing on CNN. And he had like nobody to represent him. Rick Santorum being a CNN contributor, same thing. It's like, it's just it's the product of that. It's unfortunate, but it is the product of that.
Well, I think Santorum, he gets torn up, but Santorum has his people. You know what I mean? Like, think I built my career starting out by going into these spaces, thinking I could have collegial debate, but bringing up my points and you know, being pithy from time to time, you know, and snarky. But, you know, we would sit there like you and I do.
Yeah. And but cable news is a point scoring format. It is not designed for... It's not designed for, like, some sort of, like, middle ground influence operation. It's like not... You're not, like... You know, we're going to work out the kinks, and at the end of this segment, we'll come up with a conclusion. Yeah. Like, everyone who enters the segment knows what their conclusion is. Like, the conversation is not...
It's not open-ended, definitely. But, you know, again, like, when I did the spelling thing, like, honestly, and maybe I shouldn't have thought this, but I thought she was going to find that funny. You know what I mean? I sang the song. I thought she was going to find it funny. Like, not funny, hot, like, hilarious bellyache, but like, how you got it. You know, but then answer the question about cancel culture. But she seemed really genuinely angry about it. And I was like, all right, this is a different. And like I said, with the flow of the interview.
The trick, I think, for all politicians is you've got to kind of figure out like what to let slide and what to laugh off. All of it is like trying to figure out like how people perceive you. Right.
Right.
And so what her instinct probably is, and I see it among a lot of politicians, is, you know, cocked fist, like just got to fight. Like if any suggestion of weakness, you know, or whatever, you got to fight back. You got to slam somebody in order to demonstrate to your audience that you don't put up with crap. You know, it's like we use it. A useful phrase is virtue signaling, because it's like basically that you're signaling to your audience your intent. So. But how to make those decisions is a mature thing. Like, you really have to, sometimes it's actually worth like laughing off. Like, sometimes it's like, you know, demonstrating some humility and be like, oh, I got fat fingered, whatever. But the point is, you know, and
right. And I think Jim Jordan did a good job with that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, Jim Jordan came through pleasant, you know. I'm sure there were some questions I asked that were a little uncomfortable, but he was like, you know, we're going to have a good conversation. Cicilline, right. You know, when you were digging in on Cicilline, he was like, you could see like he had some enjoyment in it.
Yeah.
Like,
he enjoyed the tumble. He wanted more of a fight, actually. So,
I think he wanted to get in the mud a little bit more, you know. And then you have someone like Ro Khanna, who I think Democrats, and I wrote this actually in an article for the Daily Caller. I don't know if you saw it. But I think Democrats really should, if Biden doesn't run in 2024, should look at Ro Khanna. Because I think Ro Khanna comes across, he's progressive, but he comes across measured in a way that I think will appeal to centrists.
Maybe so, but honestly, that this like the centrist appeal thing, I don't know if it works at like a broader electoral level. Like, you need to be pretty charismatic, typically, in order to succeed in a presidential primary. And like Andrew Yang had some niche appeal. Like he had kind of had this audience of people who liked him, but you know, it was limited. It was limited. I think Rokana would probably occupy that lane similarly. You need somebody who's like super charismatic, I think, by and large, to dominate, because the personality plays a huge role in this.
I think you need really, you know, he would need really good surrogates. And like, again, I think Bernie Sanders had that kind of niche.
But Bernie's charismatic, man.
He is charismatic.
Bernie's got energy. And this is why I was just talking about this week, you know, and we started the conversation with Lauren Boebert. Obama comes back to the White House yesterday. It's not an accident. They really could use the assist. And
for sure,
Obama cleared the primary field for Biden. Obama picked up the phone. He told Pete to get out. He told the other candidates to get out ahead of Super Tuesday. And they did. They all abandoned the field. And it allowed the primary fight to consolidate behind Biden to stop Bernie's insurgents. And that's because Bernie had a charismatic appeal to the Democratic base that Joe Biden did not. And once the establishment decided via Obama to close ranks, that was how they were able to push Biden through. But I mean, I guess without those outside forces, at the very least, in a pure contest, charisma matters a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do think it does. I don't think. I just don't know about Kamala Harris and her charisma.
If Biden hangs it up this year, let's say going into the presidential after the midterms, Biden says, no, I'm not running for reelection. Do Democrats make Kamala the nominee, or do they have a primary contest?
I think they have a primary contest.
I agree. I think you're right.
They're not in a position. I think if Biden were 60% approval and popular, then he can coronate, you know, someone else and say, hey, Kamala's it. She's an extension of me. But right now, Biden is not there. He's unpopular. Even the things he does right, he, you know, seems to do wrong with the public. Public hates him. Not hates him, but they don't like him any more than they like Trump. So I think he's, you know, I think he's got to, they've got to open it up. I think Mayor Pete would be, honestly, and I hate saying this, but Mayor Pete would be an easy choice. Easy. But right now, with LGBT issues at the forefront and many centrists becoming a little more conservative on those issues, it puts him in a really difficult spot. Mayor Pete, I've seen him, and he's another person I've seen go into conservative media and do a doggone good job. Like,
well, he's a really
good communicator.
He's smart on his feet, but I think the problem with Pete Buttigieg is that he is kind of the living embodiment of like elite perspective, right? And I don't know, like, I don't think Democratic Party needs like another elitist kind of leading the charge for their platform. And I bet you there's a real divide on this, because like, remember, Pete's like, he's a McKinsey consultant who a guy who comes from corporate America who, like, you know, remember the allegation at one point during the Democratic primary that Pete Buttigieg was involved in McKinsey advising Canadian supermarkets to fix bread prices in order to make it so that bread was more expensive for poor people. And it was like, you know, and this was the left. The left was basically like, hell with this guy. I think that those attacks would be resonant again and would be meaningfully crippling for him. I mean, like, you've got, and who am I to say who should be the nominee for the Democratic Party? I just think that somebody who's actually more in touch with like the average life of the average person in America should be at the top of the list for either party. You
know, I think his argument, again, he was mayor of a post-industrial Midwest city. The people of that city, it's a small town. I mean, you know, it's a, I guess they say mid-size, but you know, it depends on your perspective. If you're from New York or Philadelphia, it's a small
depends
town.
On if Notre Dame is playing a home game that weekend.
Right. Exactly. So I think he has some interesting, you know, things to say about the middle and the working class. He can have a message. I think Pete Buttigieg, and I talked to, I probably shouldn't say this, I talked to the Buttigieg people at one point. I chose to go with another candidate. It's kind of interesting. We find some disagreements now, but I think, the Buttigieg, Buttigieg, particularly with him being in charge of infrastructure, mm-hmm. and if the Democrats are able, once these infrastructure projects take hold and you've got good wage paying jobs from it and they're doing those things, and if the Fed can land the plane, which I don't think they will, but if they can land the plane on inflation and interest rates and not drive us into a recession, I think that Buttigieg has about as strong a position as anybody. Given Kamala, they sunk Kamala Harris by giving her immigration as a topic. That was the worst decision by the Biden administration.
Her team is reportedly very resentful about that.
And she should be. If I were on Kamala's team, I would have been like, hell, I would have raised hell in front of the president. I would have been like, that is ridiculous. This is a problem that we haven't been able to solve in four decades. You were in Congress trying to solve that problem and you failed, and not you alone, but everyone failed on that issue. The last administration tried to solve it. They couldn't solve it. The administration before that you were a part of, they couldn't solve it. Nobody has solved this issue. And now you want to put it on her plate when you're trying to say she's the heir apparent and you don't really have a solid plan for fixing it? You're sinking her political career.
I'll stipulate that I disagree with you that there wasn't progress prior to this. I think there was. The Remain in Mexico arrangements and getting the Mexican government to agree to try and stop some of the illegal immigration on their own southern border.
But you also had child separation, the Remain in Mexico situation. Some people say that created some human rights issues. People were, camped out and sick and
my point is there were some facilities. Constraints. My point is there were constraints on foreign nationals illegally entering our country that no longer exist because of conscious decisions by the Biden administration. They consciously wanted to get rid of a lot of those programs. So the end result is that more people have actually been attracted across our border by virtue of the policies of this administration, which means that if you assign Kamala Harris to fix the quote border crisis, you're giving her assignment that flies in the face of your actual administration's policies. So it's like, it was almost like, it was gaslighting. It was like, oh, she's going to stop the border crisis. Like, not really, because your administration is enabling massive waves of migration into the United States.
I'm going to disagree with that a little bit. I think what drives immigration is what's going on in Central America. And I think one of the things that they were trying to say is that she is going to be like the emissary going to Central America, encouraging people not to come, and also saying we're going to help strengthen your economy, help your situation with climate change and all the things that are driving immigration and making people want to get out. A lot of it is because they don't have jobs, because the farms are being destroyed. They got mudslides and all kinds of issues in Central America. And people are like, in order to survive, I need to get to the United States where there's more opportunities, which is the same thing a lot of people's grandparents and great-grandparents, probably the Colonnases, also did. The problem is, and again, I think Remain in Mexico, again, for people saying, well, there are parts of our border where people are coming in. The Remain in Mexico was for people essentially who were being caught at legal ports of entry and wanting to file for asylum, which is a legal process. Mm-hmm. So that created a whole lot of issues right there. I think Title 42 was fine because we had a public health crisis. But the thing is, we're not in a public health crisis anymore. It's an issue. What we need is, I know it sounds like a talking point, but comprehensive immigration reform, where we overhaul the whole issue. And that's the role of Congress. That's not the role of the president. The president can put forth a plan, but Congress has got to start to agree. But Congress is too interested in winning elections rather than helping the American people.
Let me just offer one meaningful pushback on that.
Okay.
Like, you're right. You're right. It's totally Congress's responsibility to pass laws. And if they like our immigration system to make more sense, they should pass laws that make it make sense. Because I support orderly legal immigration. I don't know how anybody could be opposed to that. Like, that's what I think most people support. Orderly legal immigration. And a secure border. A genuinely secure border. Now, it is the law right now that illegal immigration is literally illegal because it is against the law, and that illegal immigration into the United States is grounds for deportation. That is a proper punishment for illegally immigrating into the United States. Alejandro Mayorkas is the DHS secretary, and he has made a prosecutorial discretion that illegal entry alone will not be the basis for deportation from the United States. So he's made a conscious decision to ignore something that is available to him within the law. It is the law, and he's just ignoring that component. So I agree with you to an extent, which is that, Congress can pass more laws to redress the crisis. But at the same time, we have laws on the books that are being ignored. And so as a result, like, what's the solution there? And of course, now what you're seeing is states attorneys general who are suing the federal government in order to get the federal government to actually follow the letter of the law. So that's the system, playing out. But there are limitations here. If Congress can pass laws until it's blue in the face, but if the executive isn't going to enforce them, it's irrelevant.
Well, let me just say this, Vince, if Congress were like you and me, and they were able to come together and actually have conversations and actually look for points of agreement, discuss things, fight it out, and then come to some level of consensus, we would be in a different place as a country. But again, a lot of people get tightly wound. They have their talking points. They're scared of their constituents. And when they actually decide, hey, I might go against my constituents, it's because they're not running for re-election, which I think is kind of weak. You know what I mean? Like,
But
do something, stand on your principles, and then be willing to face the public. And that's what I've done my whole career.
My final thought on that is you need to have respect for your constituents, though. So I don't want anybody coming to Washington who's like, You teach, obviously, in political science. I remember just political science classes, we would talk about the difference between an elected official being a trustee or a delegate of their voters. And a delegate is basically someone who should represent sort of their popular concerns. A trustee is somebody who the populace says, we trust you so much, you handle the big questions while you're in Congress, essentially. And so I happen to think that the relationship that a lawmaker should have with his constituents is a deep respect for them. And if he doesn't yet have their support, he should earn it. He should convince them that it's a good idea and bring these issues to them. So you're right. There is some bravery involved sometimes with going against your constituents and saying, I'm going to do something completely different. But I think that the way our democratic process works is you really should have the consent of the governed. And obviously the consent of the governed plays out with each election, but it's important that you don't have such a patronizing attitude towards your constituents that you abandon them and then say you're the hero.
No, I hear that. I just know, as a student of history as well, there were a few lawmakers who, when it came to moral issues like segregation, who stepped up in the face of their constituents.
Yes.
Who told them, we oppose desegregation.
Right.
And they said, this is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I understand, about people's fear of tyranny, but there are certain times where, there's a vote there and you can't be like, well, I know this is wrong in my gut. People elect you. This is why we don't have a pure democracy. People elect you to represent their interests. And sometimes, because you are armed with more information than they are, you can make a decision and say, I know that on the surface, because you are getting this through a media filter, that you think this is wrong. But trust me, this, you entrusted in me not to just parrot your ideas, but sometimes you know,
right,
you entrusted me to make the right decision.
And right. This but if is you want right to be decision. Empowered to make those decisions again in the future, all you have to win that constituency over. That's all.
Right. And that's my thing. And that's where we're in agreement, is I think you don't just say, well, I'm going to make this decision and retire and get my little lake house where I don't, you know, and I don't have Wi-Fi, so I don't have to deal with your Twitter backlash. I think you go back in front of those constituents and you say, this is the decision I made, and this is why it was the right decision. Yeah. You know what I mean? And this is my beef with a lot of these retirees, particularly from the Republican Party, who have pushed back on Trumpism. They won't go back. And that's one thing I will say, as much as I don't like Liz Cheney, you know, as much as I can't stand her politics, which, by the way, she is more pro-Trump in her politics than Elise Stefanik by far, in terms of who voted with the president, with the former president. I think it was 77% for Elise Stefanik. 92% of the time, Liz Cheney voted with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But she is going back and facing her constituents, and some of whom are really angry. And her own party is going out after her, but she's not tucking her tail and running. She's saying, you need me more than ever now. And like I said, I'm not a fan of Liz Cheney. Let me be clear. You know, I know the left and the right will get upset with me for that. You know what I mean? Which I don't, again, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be on the Daily Caller if I was obsessed with how you feel about me. But, although I will admit sometimes it does, I'm not gonna lie, I'm not bulletproof. It does get through. You know what I mean? When you're always like, people are always angry at you.
Uh-huh. But it's the sophisticated criticisms that really get you. It's the one where they demonstrate concern and then expose some sort of vulnerability. It's like, if I was to leave in the comments right now, I can tell that Jason Nichols is full of self-doubt. They'd be like, damn, like, that was deep.
Definitely. And that's the thing. Like, I don't mind when people get angry. You know, people get like, you know, they're a little indignant and they're like, false. Yeah. And here's why. And here's my evidence. You know what I mean? I don't mind that at all.
No.
What I don't like is the, you're a moron. You know what I mean? Like, that's like I would never do that. I would never do that to Congresswoman Boebert or Congressman Jim Jordan or you know, because I just think that there's nothing. And it's funny because the first time I went on Tucker's show, I'll never forget. He was trying to rattle me. He couldn't get me to like rattle. You know, uh-huh. This is in the early days of Tucker's show when it was like dunk on the left guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he said, "You're just another tenured demagogue." And I laughed at that. You know, number one, because I wasn't tenured, but I laughed at that. And you know, it was the fact that I laughed at that. That Tucker was like, all right, I like this guy. You know what I mean? He was like, all right, he's not easily offended. He's somebody that I can have a conversation with.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was that moment that I kind of gained. He's like, all right, we're going to have you back.
Yeah, that's
and
cool.
And when you're so tightly wound and angry, it just doesn't,
it's unproductive. You
know, it's not productive. You're not even going to represent yourself well.
Man. All right. Well, this is a productive chat. You have to go. I have to go. And so does everybody else. Please like, subscribe, comment, and share, and check out our new YouTube channel. We're launching an independent YouTube channel just for Vince and Jason Save the Nation to have all these great conversations. Please subscribe to it. Thanks, everybody.
We expect to see all seven of you. Peace out.